Session three with Ben and Bob, Bob and Ben. And Ben, there's a lot of things going on everywhere in so many different environments that my perspective on my revolution is always being adjusted. And we do have an ongoing collaboration here. Maybe we're Trotsky-Lenin, maybe we're McLuhan and Ted Carpenter, maybe we're Zappa and Beefheart, maybe we're Obama and Dick Cheney, or Joe Biden and Ron Paul. Anyways, we're a duality here, and I'm wondering what could we say to our listeners, because a friend of mine, you met him, Dave Neufeld, I think it was him, he said, it sounds rather scholarly, Bob, and I don't want that to be what we're doing, though we can include that, but we're not being scholars here, are we?
I don't think so. I think you work best in a very lively, interactive, direct way, and you don't prove what you say by referring to texts, although McLuhan comes in quite a bit, but in general you feel that if something is worth saying, it's something which will be a soundbite which will work internationally over all electronic media. And that's why we both love Frank Zappa, because he found ways of saying things which were punchy and true and cut through a lot of the usual ways in which people have respect for things. And we both like that, and we both want to talk like that, and I agree with you. We don't want to be too scholarly.
Yeah, we are, you know, pretending at least that we're broadcasting from the bunker. We're trying to organize social energies to take advantage of the great breakdown that's happening now. But we know that it's tough for the particulars. We have general principles, you know, the revolution must go on, and power to the people and every other thing, plus the medium is the message, all these slogans, but the particulars. And so I immediately love and think about the Zap anecdote, which you love, about the pinheads. And, you know, when he said, hey, snazzy executive, which I think, according to the archives, that's a previous circular. It's not where he goes into the snazzy executive. You know what I mean? Into the pinhead story. Are you following?
Well, I am following. I'm surprised you call it a story. So, because the way this thing, this particular set of ideas, the way you're talking about it, I always took to be like the secret center, the secret message, the special gloss, the ultra perceptive nugget, that if you could get hold of that, then you could start to understand not only Frank Zappa, but the whole system he worked in. So I never thought this pinhead thing was just another story, because when you say a story, it sounds like, well, it's just another thing you can say. It's just another little bit of entertainment. And I always found it more crucial than that. I think the idea of, what I'm dealing with as an artist, and I think we probably aspire to the same thing, is recognizing all sorts of particulars and understanding how each particular has an eyeball fixed upon the cosmic universe, that there is no particular that is not part of the universe, going between the one and the many, going between the universe and the particular. And this shunt between the two is restricted in most areas of society. It seems to me nobody's doing it, and we're trying to do it, and that's why I think what we're trying to do in these discussions is revolutionary.
Yes, I misspoke when I said story. I agree exactly that it's the nugget, it's the core of Zappa trying to explain what he was doing up to that point. But I immediately think of nobody's doing it. The actual description of the little pinhead is an eyeball in the universe, that is what the internet is giving people. They got their own broadcasting nexus, Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, and they can create, and everybody can be in touch with everybody else. It's an interesting extension of what Zappa was thinking about. You see, McLuhan pointed out, not McLuhan, Don Thiel, McLuhan's greatest student next to me. Don Thiel went on to become president of Trent University in Ontario, Canada. He said that Phineas Wake anticipated digital culture. And he agrees, and he read your book, Ben. He died April 2008. But he read your book, and I have essays of his new book. Chapters from his new book that his widow gave me. It isn't published yet, but there's sections and annotations, references to Ben Watson's Negative Dialectic, it's a fool play, because Don Thiel did his PhD on James Joyce and Wyndham Lewis and Pound, no, not Wyndham Lewis, James Joyce, Pound, Eliot, and Yeats in 1953, under McLuhan. It's McLuhan's first PhD student. It's a fantastic thesis, but he was always up to date, and when I turned him on to Zappa, which he had heard a bit about in the 60s, and you read your book, you were in the book. You're in a heavy, one of the top Joycean critics in the world. So good that the other Joyceans don't like him. But
Bob, I'm so glad that finally I've entered the world of scholarship in this way.
You have?
Yeah, I'm in the footnotes. See, I mean, this is so satisfying.
We're quadriphenic. We just when we're denying our scholarship motives, all of a sudden I quote a scholar. Okay, so the point is that Thiel's not like that. So he's anticipating, he sees that Finnegan's Wake anticipated not just television, as McLuhan saw, but digital culture. And he also saw the importance of Zappa's work within that. And so can we say, or I'm saying now maybe, that the Pinhead, if you want to restate what it is, what we're referring to, but the Pinhead, I don't have it right on the top of my head what it is, but the Pinhead conceptual continuity that he referred to is an anticipation of the digital environment we're in, where everybody is their own center.
Well, I have a block, I suppose. I don't know whether to go in with my big disagreements or whether my gloss that might be more friendly. I mean, I can start telling you about Frank Zappa's statements in the particular... it began as a fraudulent interview, which was part of a promotional device of Warner Records in 1971. It became part of the press release for 200 Motels, and it's an interview. And I mean, I could run off if you can. You've got a couple of minutes and find it and read it to you. Although when
no, let's not do that.
No, we won't do that. But the Pinhead idea is about how. What we're dealing with is cultural tokens. Each token has a meaning. And what you're doing when you're doing any cultural work is you're stacking up all these bits and pieces that aren't created by yourself. They're little words or ideas or stories that you've derived from elsewhere, and you stack them up in different ways, and we're all stacking up and shuffling these cards. It's like the cards that you're dealing when you're talking to people. And on each one of them, I think Zappa's trying to explain that they have a picture which is infinitely detailed. And so you can't reduce any of these cards and say, well, I know that card. Because if you look into any of these pieces, you find that the whole of the world is concentrated in it. So we're continually dealing with these bright, shiny, extraordinary things called the bits and pieces we communicate with. And if you concentrate on one of them, and this is what all poets find, all scholars find, anybody who stops and looks finds, that all the bits we're dealing with are infinitely detailed, that you can find the whole history of mankind and the natural history of the world from studying one atom. And also this is stuff which physicists are telling us, that by looking closely at any particular thing, it seems to turn inside out. You start staring out at the wider universe. And I think that's what Zappa was getting at with the Pinhead argument.
No, I agree. And I don't know if I brought this up in the previous hours, that in his United Mutations, his particular application to join a group he started...
Rather than the United Nations. I mean, United Mutations is like a reply to the United Nations saying, this kind of internationalism is not quite enough. That just by taking the nation states of the world and joining them together, you actually produce something quite fraudulent and wrong. And that what we need is the United Mutations. And by turning nation into mutation, he implied that change and development are the central thing, not this controlling one area of the world and arming yourself to the teeth versus the other little areas. That maybe the nation state way of organizing the world is defunct and we should move on to some new level. I think that's contained in the term United Mutations.
Yes, and remember the quote we started off with in the first session from Zappa: can prolonged exposure to mixed media produce mutations? Okay, well, I brought that up because
of the GTOs. I mean, I just support you by singing the GTOs. I'm a television baby.
Yes, yes. Yeah. It's a good album. favorite musician he lists in his application to the United Mutations is, one of them is Buckminster Fuller. Okay? And I got a chance a couple of years later, when was that? No, 10 years later, I got a chance to ask him, why did he put in Buckminster Fuller? And I expected, you know, some scholarly, just some more inventory of his understanding of Bucky Fuller. And he said, well, I was driving along the highway, I think in L.A. someplace, one day, and someone pointed out a Bucky Fuller architecture, and I'm assuming it was the geodesic dome. I'm not sure, but it seemed to be that. And it was just like when he looked at Joyce and said, this is good. This guy had it right. Anyways, he was driving along. Someone pointed out the geodesic dome. He saw it. He said, that's cool, or that's interesting, or that's great, and then drove past. That's all he had to refer to, that someone pointed out, and he said, that's great. And then he found out, probably the guy said who he was, Buckminster Fuller, unless Frank already knew that, but he lists him as a major musical influence. Isn't that interesting? A passing item.
Yeah, but then, with Frank, when he's a very judgmental person. He always decides which side he's on. He's not bland. He doesn't say, oh, well, I've understood it. I don't know yet what I think about it. His immediate response is to say, do I agree with it or disagree with it? He looked at a few pages of Ulysses and decided, that's real. I like Joyce. He didn't need to read lots of it. He just liked it. The same way looking at the geodesic dome and Buckminster Fuller. And that kind of commitment and decision to stand with or against what he responds to immediately, you know, from the surface of it, is for me very critical of the usual sophisticated response, which is to say, I don't know where I stand on anything, but I know about everything. You know, that it's an interruption to that, and it's very different and refreshing. And that's why I love Frank. I realized that I loved it from the very beginning. As soon as I heard it, I knew that stank in certain circles to be like that, to actually put your balls on the line, in that expression. And he always did. Don't you think it's an example of that?
Yep. He didn't have time to... he wouldn't consider whether it was correct politically or whatever to say something. Just say it. Regardless of the consequences. That's what you like, right?
Well, I do, but there are numerous shock jocks of varying degrees of quality who think they're doing that, but don't come out with something like Frank Zappa. That Frank Zappa also, with this immediacy of expression and holding on to his immediate impression to things, also had a whole social attitude, a whole attitude towards people, and a sympathy with childhood and a support for the delinquent, and you know, holding on to early experience, even though he became very successful and like a top person towards the end of his life, a kind of sympathy with and a memory for his initial experience as being an Italian-American, kind of, you know, not on the right end of things in his high school and everything. And I think he didn't forget that. He kept on to it. I don't know whether you're like that, Bob, but I find I'm very similar, that I hold on to how I was not popular at school at various times, and I remember it. And he's like got solidarity with his earlier suffering self.
All right. I'm not that. I'm talking to you. But
one thing we should tell listeners, we're not allowed to find out about Bob. He's a mysterious entity called Bob Purple.
No, I tell everybody what I am, but just nobody believes it. And
all right.
I'm not spending my life proving who I am. I know who I am, and time will show that everything I say is accurate. But let me respond to this. What comes to mind to prove your point of him remembering the underdogs, remember in one of the society pages, when the guy who did the vocals on Pat Robertson, that Eric guy, you know Eric? He read the letter, the manifesto. Or the
He's the guy who got into trouble with the audience because he kind of voiced he went and did a parody of a preacher kind of dissing Zappa, and his story was that members of the audience thought he was real and wanted to beat him up after the show.
Yeah? I don't know if that's it. You know, I'm talking about when Eric, whatever his last name is, he reads the biography of Pat Robertson.
Yeah.
You know, criminal this, went to school, blah, blah, blah. Anyways, Eric, he was on the 88 tour, and he was on Broadway the Hardware. I think that's the album. But anyways, he and a bunch of other guys, like Den, you know, the guy who was the, you know, a fanatic, obsessive analyzer of Zappa's musical notation. Den, remember? Den and Eric and another guys, to me, street guys, they got into Frank's house, you know, in 89, 90, and he spent like 5 hours with him. And the interview got published in Mr. Society Pages. But the point is, I knew Eric, I met him and met these people. Like, here's Frank hanging out, quote, with these people just before, you know, just before he's going to go to Frankfurt and do the thing with John Cage and all that. This to me shows that he kept in touch with whoever was interested and had the energy to show up at his house and entertain him or prompt him. You know, that long interview?
Yeah, your voice is beginning to break up. I don't know if we've got a technological problem, but for me, this is a product of the whole freak aesthetic. The whole idea of being a freak is the idea of not respecting these particular levels we're meant to live on, and responding immediately to whatever's around you, and that's the ideal. That's how we should all live. That's it's a very strong idea of how to behave and what to do.
Yes, and I'm looking at the Bucky Fuller idea, and then I'm going to say something in immediate response to what you just said. But before I do that, Don Thiel talked about the key idea of the artist-engineer in the Radical Modernist movement. All the famous great artists, they all thought that they were artist-engineers and were up on science and that. The thing is that Bucky Fuller fits into that world. And then you take a Frank quote summarizing the history of the Mothers. He says, "The Mothers managed to perform in alien time signatures and bizarre harmonic climates with a subtle ease that led many to believe it was all happening in 4/4 with a teenage backbeat." Just him interacting with these people that you were just citing and I was citing are bizarre harmonic climates. So it applies to the architectural environments he was creating, and it also applies to who he interacted with and how he was open and remained consistent. That could be part of the conceptual continuity, that he knew he was staying who he was. Who, in fact, he was when he was young, and he stayed that way, but he added to it. But since it was all one album, all one time, then his life included what he was when he was a kid or a teenager, up all the way through to the end. You get what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, I think I do. I mean, I'm thinking about people could be bizarre harmonic climates. Once you say a thing like that, you get to the idea that there is no a huge chasm between reality and culture, or between art and society, that there is no that you could improvise on the material strewn at random on your desk, that you don't have to have a score to play, that there is no text that we're all trying to master and that we're repeating, that you can look at the sky and you can find that to be something which will make you sing, that these things go from one to the other. And it seems kind of obvious. I mean, all poets, all musicians stare at the sky and play from it. But you get an attitude about culture, which actually is the general attitude, which makes what we're saying revolutionary. So the general attitude is that there are just various areas of practice that you master, that you learn from, and you keep within those, and then you shine within those. And anybody outside it can't understand what you're doing. That culture are, they're competing identity cultures of different people doing different things, and it fits into the idea of society as a war of all these different people against each other. Whereas this idea that the street people might be a harmonic environment in which you could improvise opens up the idea that to be a real modern composer, you need to learn to talk to people that maybe you haven't dared to talk to before. That to be a real composer means to be daring socially. It opens up a whole area which they don't teach you in music college, and is something that I always try and tell young musicians. Well, actually, to produce good music, you've got to dare to do things socially, which maybe this tight little education you've got doesn't allow you to do.
No, exactly. So bugaboo of specialism, which McLuhan says comes in with the printing press, is what we're stuck with in this today as an afterimage in this encyclopedic information environment. Now, I wanted to ask you, did Marx say anything about specialisms? Was he anti that tendency? Was it happening in his day?
Well, the whole of Capital is about how modern production is based upon the division of labour. And the division of labour, which is produced not because of people wanting to specialise in things, but because that's what produces a profit, as if you rationalise it. And I mean, he's writing before Henry Ford and Taylorisation and these sort of processes, but he's predicting them, that to make maximum profits, it's best to get certain people doing one thing and then they pass along the thing that they've made and so on. And the whole of his work is about trying to understand why this produces a monstrous system where nobody really understands everything, because everybody is being divided up to compete to produce the very best widget, and they end up not understanding what the widget's for. And this is actually our experience of most of us in this society in earning money. We absolutely know we must master this particular area of understanding how labels are read in the pharmaceutical trade, and then we get very brilliant at understanding the psychology of reception and these words and so on. And we can't stand back and look and say, well, why is everybody consuming these pharmaceuticals? What is going on that everybody's so intent on their skill and having their career that they can't stand back and look at the whole thing? And for me, the whole of Marxism is about trying to understand and criticise what the situation is, in which people could say to you, yeah, I hate what's happening to the world as a whole, but I have to earn my money, I've got to go and do this. And this madness, this split, is absolutely, I think, what Marx was trying to address.
Yeah, excellent. Good answer. McLuhan thought the electric environment could lead to a non-specialist society.
I would say that Karl Marx uses different terms, but in exactly the same way, he believes that the capitalist society could lead to a revolution and a rational way of seizing all the. I mean, people misunderstand. They think that Karl Marx is so anti-capitalist. He wants to go back to something before. Not at all. He praised capitalism in the sense that it produces all these energies and this division of labour and all these extraordinary things going on all over the world. His complaint is it hasn't gone far enough. It's always a progressive criticism of capitalism. So when I think you say electronic media from the McLuhanite vocabulary, often I'm saying capitalism from the Marxist vocabulary, but the position on it, which is that are these all these amazing things produced which you conservatives just do not understand, you're sitting in your specialisms, you're just sitting there living in the past, but it doesn't mean I'm simply going hooray hooray for today, you know, that there's something more to be done.
Exactly. So McLuhan's, you know, genius was to point out to the literate culture that the very medium, the book that they, quote, worshipped, unquote, was the archetype of fragmentation and specialization. And he says, you're not looking at the new electronic society and media that counters the book. And I see a lot in your writing that you criticize the hoity-toity, snobbish book people, the print-oriented bastards, who maintain this snotty illusion of holding up some values and miss the action everywhere else in their ivory tower.
Well, I do, Bob, but at the same time, I feel quite double about it, because in some ways I really like the people who stick to the book and who take the book seriously and want to pick up books and look at them. And I feel that a lot of the people who think they're in charge of literary culture and resist the bad pop culture actually don't know what the book culture is anyway.
Exactly. McLuhan used to say that semi-literate people have no clue about the what he called figure ground effects of literacy, and he said a truly literate person is someone who's not identifying with the process of the book, but recognizes them and works with that, within it. Like Frank worked with sound. I mean, there was a guy who was detached about what he made as he made it. He could see through the effects of what he was making as he was doing, and he always was ironic about it. Like, I remember that song in Freakout, he's criticizing society, and then he says, but after all, I'm just a musician. Maybe I'm just here to play. You remember that?
Yeah, where he says, maybe that's not for me to say. They only pay me here to play.
Yeah. And I want to cite the revolutionary part of what we're doing here. Zappa did include in his conceptual continuity running for president. And I talked to Cal Schenkel. I know that Frank talked about it in 1970 or so. They were joking about running Tom Wilson, I think. But Cal Schenkel told me, yes, Frank was secretly running for president starting in 68. And so Frank wanted to be a great artist, engineer, and mold society, at least in a way. Remember he called it in the Frank Kosky interview back in 67, the jazz and pop interview, he called, we'll call ourselves the Interested Party. Do you remember that?
I do, and... His meeting Frank Kosky always struck me very powerfully because Frank Kosky wrote the book Free Jazz and Black Nationalism and interviewed Archie Shepp and was from all that side of things. And many people try and make a separation between free jazz and that politics and Frank Zappa. And they always point out, well, Frank Zappa said he didn't like jazz and produce all these kind of nerdish, specialized divisions. When, from Frank's point of view, I could always see that he responded to the very best in jazz. He always refused the big old heritage lie, which all the jazz musicians, the real jazz musicians, hate anyway, and honed in on very specific people that could help him build what he wanted to do, which is just the attitude towards tradition that we should have. That tradition becomes a headache, tradition becomes an oppression. Oh yes, I've inherited the classical tradition, I've inherited the literary tradition. People who talk like that never know what they're talking about. But people said, well, I read this passage in Rabelais, which I thought was amazing, and I can do this with it. They're the real people. And Frank, for me, talked like that. He wasn't pompous about areas of culture. He just responded and used it. And his responses to Charlie Mingus and Eric Dolphy give me absolutely no doubt he could respond to areas of jazz completely, but quite rightly he objected to you could explain it better to than I could, Bob, this particular American idea of jazz, which kind of makes me sick to my stomach, actually. You know, when the media deal with it and they go, this is a jazz thing, and you get this sort of... I'm a loss for words to express how different from the responding to the music I find that kind of commercial representation is.
We're still being consistent. You're objecting to the categorical imperative or the specialist category, which the media do. But what was I going to say? I think that Kosky Zappa interview is really important. It was two parts. And, David Wally either read that and then got in touch with Jazz and Pop. And Pauline, whatever her name was, she hired him, and he became a music critic for Jazz and Pop. And that Pauline went on to be Jim Morrison's mistress, and is portrayed in the Doors movie, Oliver Stone's Doors movie, as the kind of witch, you know, the witch who initiates him or something. That was the editor, Pauline somebody, I think it was, a good friend of Dave Wally's, but I bring this up because that Kosky Zappa dialogue is really interesting, because you get a Marxist meeting a savvy media guy who comes out of advertising. So it's sort of like McLuhan and Marx.
It's sort of like a preview of our conversations now.
Exactly. it really, because I didn't follow all of Kosky. He disappeared, but I think I got the feeling he got disappointed, Frank, because you can see him in the interview. He's willing to say, my God, we got this guy. He's got this power. In 1967, this could be the fulfillment of Marx's dream, to the degree that Kosky was a Marxist, literally. But he's all excited, and then I think he's shocked that Zappa never heard of Bertolt Brecht, things like that, part of the Frankfurt School canon or something. But he was intrigued by Zappa, but I think he gets disappointed later. Does that sound familiar?
Very familiar. I mean, an awful lot of very worthy, educated Marxists love Frank Zappa up until Flo and Eddie. And it seems to me that that's just when your Freudian sensibilities should kick in. And if you haven't got them, then you just lose it. That you can't stand the way that somebody who used to seem very clearly to pursue a culture of social comment has somehow moved on to saying, well, we're cabaret and it's funny and we're vulgar and we don't care and all these things. But art should never care. You know, art that cares is always a lie, because art is about exuberance and about celebration. It has its own function. And for art to say it cares, always to me, is like caring in the wrong place. That if you really care, you're not doing art. You know, you're really caring.
That's right. And so Zappa shows that he's not a specialist, because he goes on, and while he's doing the flow and any stuff, he does get hurt, but very quickly he resurfaces with the Grand Wazoo and then the Petit Wazoo, which is the album of that. The Petit Wazoo, Measuring Disease, is a great album.
And, yeah. Bob, we're half an hour in, and your voice is breaking up, and I'm thinking about the recording, so I'm thinking, should we just stop and realign ourselves?
Yes, yeah. I'm going to hang up you.
So we're halfway through now, and so this is part one of Bob Dobbs and Ben Watson talking about everything, but kind of based on Frank Zappa. And we're just going to cut it here and carry on for another half hour very soon.
Yeah, you're going to cut me off, then call me right back.
Okay.